All right, everybody. Thank you for sticking with this. I think there's some unresolved questions we should probably revisit at what will be our last stop. But I wanted to at least spend a little time reflecting with you on, international, global justice, again, with this kind of Rawlsian framework or bringing in other considerations. Because as we all know, as we've discussed, like it's hard enough to kind of get a just society within your own borders, but questions of justice, questions of fairness don't end at borders. And in situations of migration or situations of refugee situations, right, those borders don't, they're porous in all kinds of ways. And this kind of setup of justice within one's borders and justice outside one's borders, that kind of dichotomy becomes very complicated and falls apart pretty quickly. So again, I think there are multiple ways in which Rawls himself, he did write a bit on sort of international justice and how to extend his principles internationally. And then there's a set of scholars who probably take Rawls in more radical directions than he even imagined. And so I can get into that, but I guess I was really pleased with the conversation last time. So I guess I'll just turn the floor over to you to begin. Like, what kinds of questions or problems or issues do you see coming up? Taliban was already mentioned. When we start to think about extending this sort of idea of justice to international territories, to other democratic societies or to non-democratic societies, etc. So I'm happy just to kind of hear what questions and thoughts you have. Yeah, please, David.
And so I think the international case just amps up a concern that I was already having at the last stop. We just didn't have time for.
Okay, go for it.
Which, as I'm thinking about Rawls' first principle here, mm-hmm. about this basis in freedom, mm-hmm. It seems to me like one of the things that has to account for, and as I recall Rawls, he kind of tries to account for, mm-hmm. in this case, but please set me straight if I'm, is the freedom to be wrong. Right? If my freedom means anything in the modern sense, it means that I can have the wrong value. Mm-hmm. It means that I can have the wrong ideals. It means that I can have the wrong goals, as seen by pretty much everybody mm-hmm. from outside of me. And so we see that set up where we have communities in different nations having coherent values amongst themselves that are not shared mm-hmm. across national borders. Mm-hmm. But I think we also see it at an individual level in these various cases, right? So Maurice and I were talking about that a little bit on the meander mm-hmm. up here. But what the space is for that being, like, really wrong about the basic things. So I can imagine that I'm a terminally ill individual, right, who, I value above all not dying if I possibly can. Mm-hmm. I'm going to spend the last several years of my life in a hospital using up extraordinarily amounts of medical resources and money and doctor's time and hospital beds and all these things to keep me alive for a couple of more months. Mm-hmm. Because it's so important to me that I not die until the very last. Mm-hmm. Someone else, even who just valued like a good death at home, or who valued like not taking the resources from those who might mm-hmm. live longer or whatever, there still is something in our community that we say it's okay to have what might, from someone else's perspective, be the wrong value mm-hmm. in wanting to not die yet. Mm-hmm. We want to leave room, even at the basic questions of life and death and when we die, mm-hmm. when and how and what, to disagree radically in ways that inconvenience each other. Mm-hmm. Right? And again, across international things. So am I right that Rawls would peg that freedom to be wrong about values as part of the first principle? And if not, where will he find a home for it?
No, I think that's right. And I think that's part of, in Rawls's terminology, saying that this is a political conception of justice. It's not a wholesale understanding of the good, right? So that we should, there has to be a kind of protection of pluralism. Now, I think some of the questions last time were starting to bang up against, like, when does that pluralism actually rub onto something that is impinging on somebody else, right? But as even as Perry was talking, where are you, Perry? There. So somebody values money above all else, right? And I think in a Rawlsian framework, right, if I can show that your pursuit of money is compromising the freedoms of other people, then fine. I have some grounds in a Rawlsian system for for challenging you. But if my problem with your pursuit of money is just that I think you're fundamentally wrong about the value of money, right? I think you, other things are important, right? Philosophy and, I don't know, baking really good sourdough bread or like whatever I like to do. And I think you're fundamentally, I don't actually think that's the way I can go at you in a Rawlsian framework, right? And I mean, the death cases are really interesting because I do think there's a way in which there are probably certain Rawlsian principles where I could say to somebody, yeah, you're disadvantaging somebody else by taking those resources. And we've kind of decided that that's one we don't necessarily want to touch. Like, we'd rather be pluralist there and preserve pluralism than really demand a strict kind of Rawlsian accounting of inequality and justice.
So this is where whether the two principles are co-equal or there's a hierarchy between the first and the second principle, I think is really important at one point. But I think that I think that death case is about the closest parallel I could come up to with the environmental case.
Mm-hmm.
And I meant it as such.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
In terms of like,
oh, when the rubber hits the road and I'm actually inconvenienced, am I still a pluralist about values or not?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right? I think that, you know, I think that the death case should make us as uncomfortable as the environmental case makes us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not uncomfortable the same amount about both,
why?
We're being inconsistent with ourselves.
Interesting. Yeah. Thoughts, reactions?
The last stop I was super, super excited about the
not so much anymore.
The veil of ignorance. And now you ask this question and now you tempered my excitement.
Oh, no. We needed somebody excited.
Is it possible, Ed, that this whole thing is flawed because it's predicated on who is included in the community to whom this justice is extended to? So if all of us here were to be behind that veil this morning and we get to make up this stuff, right, to deal with these inequalities...
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are not representative of this, let's say, the Montana society.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever we select to be behind the veil is already flawed because it will most likely not include all the stakeholders. So it doesn't really matter what we come up with because the guy or the person who's on the outside is going to cry foul.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't include me. And not in a literal sense, but in a representative sense. And because there's always more, to your example, international borders, you know, outer space, you know, the galaxy. Where is this going to end?
Yeah.
Other species.
Yeah, I think it's the right question to ask, right? So what kind of cat are you letting out of the bag, so to speak? Now, I think with the Montana case, Rawls would say... Right, we're setting the rules of justice, the principles of justice for a certain society, and it's going to be an obvious foul not to include the perspectives of anybody who's in that society. And again, we're including their perspectives in kind of an indirect way because we're all kind of veiling ourselves from knowing who exactly we're going to be, but we should have some idea of whose perspectives we have to think about, right? So if it's whatever the divide is between us here and somebody who's on the outside, right, if we know that person's going to be in our society, we've got to include that as a possibility of where we could end up behind the veil.
Sorry, can I just add really quick?
Yeah.
Tracy and I were just talking about that. That assumes that you understand their world enough that you could actually speak on their world, right? Which is a false notion, I believe. Like, do any of us really know what it's like to be homeless, and therefore do we understand enough to speak on that behalf? So if we're supposed to be representative, what if our view is really limited by our experience?
But I think there's a way in which, right, there's always something of, Rawls likes to give labels to everything he does, and it drives me nuts, right? So he calls this for like something like reflective equilibrium, where we're always kind of going back to our principles behind the veil and evaluating our society. So, and this might not be good enough, but I think the way he would handle that is, so there's one moment where I'm saying, I could end up as homeless and maybe I'm not considering the needs of homeless people well enough. And that's the work the veil can do. Like, the veil can help me realize I haven't thought about this other way I could have ended up, right? I need to devise some sort of policy or social protections, whatever it is, that helps that person sort of benefit from the other inequalities in society. But then I'd have to come out. Then I would have to kind of come out of the veil and go talk to that person, probably.
Yeah.
Right? I'd have to actually say, like, what are your needs? Because I know I need to protect your freedoms. I know I need to benefit you. We have all kinds of ways in which people's good intentions backfire because they're kind of paternalistic or think they know what's better for somebody else. And so I don't think the veil is meant to do all that work. Right? The veil gives me a diagnosis that, like, I can't have a system that doesn't include that person and that person's benefit. It might be outside the veil where I have to actually go talk to those communities and say, is this the kind of thing that works for you or not? Because I'm concerned with your participation in this society.
Thank you.
So yeah, I think it's a limit. There is a kind of going back and forth. And the other way, right, if I'm outside of it and I'm always assuming, like, yeah, everything we're doing is helping the least advantaged members of the society, GDP is rising, stocks are good, whatever, that's the work the veil can then do to say, like, wait, you know, I'm kind of myopic and home including.
Yeah,
this
my
is kind of getting back to, like, who decides, and, you know, like, as George Will said, you know, we decide who decides.
Mm-hmm.
So those deciders that we have chosen have to get into the mud, have to get into the nitty-gritty and learn about those people, or bring representatives onto their staff that they know can really teach them about it so they can empathize with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they need to have the desire to look at those points of view, and I think that's the flaw with a lot of power, is it gives you a position where you don't have to look at the other side. And I mean, the wolf example is a really good one here in Montana. You know, the people who put that forward were people who had trapping businesses and who wanted to, you know, mount a wolf head on their wall or whatever they do with dead wolves, I don't know.
Well, take their perspective and find out, right? Veil of ignorance.
So they weren't, they had no desire to, they were given alternative viewpoints by...
They're even given facts.
Right, qualified people. It wasn't just opinion. And they just weren't interested in it. And so if you have a society where that occurs, how do you apply these kind of...
You have to choose people of integrity.
True. Hmm. That's it.
It's not obvious that from Rawls' perspective, behind the veil of ignorance, there is such thing as qualified versus unqualified people. It's not mm-hmm. clear to me how that's consistent with ignorance about our own values mm-hmm. and about the equality of values mm-hmm. that we get under the first principle.
Mm-hmm.
It seems if that equality of values includes values that seem to others to be wrong mm-hmm. once we're outside of the veil.
Right.
I have a hard time reconciling that with the washed and the unwashed masses, the qualified and the unqualified. I don't see where Rawls has a leg to give us that, mm-hmm. nor do I think he would want to.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
So the Taliban.
Yeah.
I mean, when we do speak of values, like, clearly as a westernized society, ours, you know, go head to head to theirs, and they're very different mm-hmm. and very wrong mm-hmm. To a lot of us.
Yeah.
And we think, as a powerful westernized country, how beautiful our lives are. Let's go over there and make their lives mm-hmm. beautiful and westernized. And the Taliban is a reaction to that expansion of, these are our ideals, these are our values, we're coming in and we're gonna change yours to, you know, maybe benefit you guys, but also infringe upon your own values. And I think the Taliban is a reaction to that.
Yeah, so where Rawls himself goes,
yeah.
And I'll just say that and then keep this conversation going, right? In his own work on this, I think, And, you know, he's developing this theory kind of at the end of the Cold War, right? So he's got a kind of tiered system where he sees, okay, let's just assume for a second, we've brought up all our complications, let's assume we've achieved a reasonably just democratic society. like, how are you going to deal internationally? Well, there are going to be tiers, right? So if you're dealing with other reasonably just democratic societies, those societies in their negotiations, in their agreements, in their accords, will enter something like a kind of international state of ignorance where they say, we're going to have basic principles of fairness, we're going to try to benefit each other through trade or whatever. This is something like, I don't know, maybe the ideal of a UN model, maybe it's something of a NATO model, right? You have another tier of states that Rawls, and this is where a lot of liberals critique him, it's a little harder, where he considers well-ordered hierarchical societies. And a well-ordered hierarchical society for him is one where people have most basic rights, but maybe there's not full equality. So maybe you have to be, let's say, I don't know, a Sunni Muslim to hold positions of power, but like the Shia are not like completely discriminated against, right? So there's a hierarchy of religious values, but there's general kind of free economy stuff like this. Rawls actually thinks that liberal societies could engage in just international diplomatic relations with them. Some people wonder whether or not you can have fair relations with other societies that aren't perfectly just. And then there are kind of the two harder cases. There are some societies that are so poor or so decimated by colonialism or whatever it is, decimated by war, that they are, Rawls calls them burden societies, which is... we can make whatever you want of the term, but, you know, in somehow their material resources or their cultural resources are such that we should not even expect them to be achieving the principles of justice yet. And Rawls thinks our duties there are to help them. For Rawls, we are responsible for helping burdened societies, not so much because we're in some international original position, which is where some thinkers take it, but because it's kind of enlightened self-interest. Like we should want the world to consist of other good societies and healthy societies. It helps stability. And then there are finally for him kind of outlier states, which are countries that are not burdened, but they just have no interest in Western democratic norms. And he doesn't really have a theory for how to deal with those, right? I don't think he thinks there is a theory, right, that would fit all situations. You act prudentially. And so then we're going to get all into all kinds of arguments over what prudent action looks like, right? And does nation building, is that a prudent way to handle these countries? Or are sanction regimes prudent ways to deal with these countries? Or whatever your international war game option is, or diplomatic option is. So, you know, he's got this very kind of tiered system, but it presumes kind of contained societies internationally negotiating. There are other thinkers, notably, I mean, I recommend you read Cuk-Tortan at the University of Pennsylvania, who says, well, wait a minute, and I think this was part of Thomas's query, like, once you kind of start thinking about this veil of ignorance, shouldn't everybody in the world be under this veil? Right? Maybe we're presuming I know I'm going to be a Montana or I know I'm going to be an American, but maybe I should expand this sort of construct to say, I don't know if I'm going to be an American or a citizen of Spain, or I'm going to be an Algerian, or I'm going to be a Cambodian, or whatever I'm going to be. And what do principles of justice look like there? What does inequality look like and remedying inequality look like there? And so, I mean, there's the death question and the two principles. I think that's one hard one. But always, I think this question of when have we sufficiently extended our kind of moral thinking and our thinking about justice under the original position, and what's that commit us to? I think that's another really hard question in international affairs.
We need to get a whole bunch of people who believe in reincarnation together to talk about these things, because they could come back as anything, right? Just yeah. Kidding.
Yeah. Well,
in my past life.
Yes.
Ed?
Yeah.
You know, I may be totally reading into Rawls's work here on this one, but I have not read him. But doesn't he kind of approach the whole thing as a negotiation, mm-hmm. and in the context of contracts.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that And if indeed that's the case, like you think of it as a contract that we would make mm-hmm. within society, mm-hmm. then you can sort of think about, just like all of us have entered into a contract before, mm-hmm. you have to be a willing participant, party to the contract. Mm-hmm. It's not like somebody cannot necessarily impose a contract on you, or of course they can coerce you into it, but mm-hmm. but so the idea, I like the idea, and maybe that's a way to think about this, is negotiating the terms of the contract and then being a willing negotiator and participant to the execution of that contract. Mm-hmm. And so then whether or not the Taliban are included, they could say, hey, we don't want to be part of the mm-hmm. no stinking contract.
Yeah.
And so, well, then right there, that would, you know, limit this veil that you're going to drop on the mm-hmm. on a certain number of people, mm-hmm. and this wouldn't include the Taliban because they would just not be interested in that particular, no matter what the contract looks like.
Yeah,
I don't know. That,
mm-hmm. I think that's really instructive on the work, kind of this original position as a kind of contractor negotiation does for Rawls, right? Because I think we've been again and again asking about what if people don't share, you know, basic democratic values. And yeah, I think for Rawls, that's a really helpful work that this can do. Namely, you're presuming people who want to kind of enter into a negotiation, mm-hmm. right? You presume they want a kind of fair outcome. And what the original position of this veil of ignorance can do is help them better understand what fair negotiation will be, so that if you are negotiating in a way that clearly benefits you, I can call you out on it, right? And say you're benefiting in a way that privileges you. I think there's this other kind of way of interpreting Rawls, and I've been trying not to get into too many weeds, but which says, you know, really the contract doesn't do a whole lot of work. When I enter the veil of ignorance, what I'm saying is I could end up as anybody. What would be fair if I ended up as anybody? And I could kind of just deduce from myself, right, what would be fair, you know, if I ended up as anybody? And you could kind of construe the whole system as a I don't know, almost kind of a mind of God, ideal observer of the world. And I think from that perspective, that's when people start to say, well, maybe it doesn't matter who's entering the contract, right? Because I can also still think of myself, what if I ended up as an Afghani citizen or something, or what if I ended up here? So no, I do think this contract language and the contract kind of idea does help Rawls answer some of these questions of who's included, right? It presumes willing parties, and I think it helps him. But that I don't know from a pure kind of ideal moral perspective if that makes everybody comfortable with who might be left out of that, or excluded from that, maybe not of their own will, maybe because of the circumstances of their birth or something like that. Yeah, David.
I just as I'm listening to this exchange that you and Thomas are having here, Ed, mm-hmm. I'm calling back to something I think from the first stop as mm-hmm. we're discussing here, which is the difference between thinking of this as getting us a political program mm-hmm. of justice mm-hmm. and not as getting us moral
yeah.
principles
yep. good.
As mm-hmm. such. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good.
And so if that's right, and especially because you used the word moral just at mm-hmm. the end here,
yeah.
I guess we've all been doing a little bit of it in these
both.
Last couple
yep.
of discussions mm-hmm. around moral issues mm-hmm. more than around political issues, mm-hmm. right? So on the one hand, just holding that distinction fast in our minds.
Yep.
But then on the other hand, it might do some work for us in terms of who's included. If it's a political conception, there is some polity.
Right.
There's some polis
yes. mm-hmm.
or other mm-hmm. that it's a political conception for.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's a really good way of summarizing, I think, what I mean by, you know, the contract doing some work for him. Right?
Okay, you I got you. Cool.
Right. That contract is assuming a polity. It's assuming yeah. contracting parties.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, again, some of the other scholarship I'm bringing that wants to extend this to other species or extend this to kind of a cosmopolitan conception is not letting Rawls have that fast distinction between a political conception and a moral conception yeah. of justice, right? Yeah. If I'm really starting to think about not knowing my position, which is a way of saying that there are some things about me that are relevant to my making claims on you, and there are other things about me that are not relevant, right? So if I'm making a claim saying you owe me something because I'm male, that's not relevant. But if I'm making a claim saying I'm a rational human being, that is relevant. And sort of, I think for some thinkers, once you let that out of the bag, you're no longer thinking about a polity. You're thinking about humanity in general or species in general. But I think you're right. In terms of what Rawls wants, he wants that fast distinction. And it has a lot of sense to it. But, you know, I mean, for thinkers who start talking about not just, let's say, tax schemes within a society, but who start trying to argue for, let's say, like global resource taxes, right? Let's tax countries who have more resources to then support countries who have fewer. I don't think that's what Rawls envisioned, but there's a lot of Rawlsian, there's a big Rawlsian framework you can use to kind of employ that. You didn't know behind the veil if you'd end up in a rich country, if you'd be a rich country or a poor country. So if you are a rich country, don't you owe something to the upkeep of poor countries? I find that stuff fun, but it's probably not Rawls.
Back to Dana's point, how could you understand that? Like, you might say, oh, it doesn't matter if I end up a poor country. I hear they're really happy anyway. Because you haven't been hungry for 3 days or not had a bathroom or whatever. And so, I mean, that was what was done in the slave era, saying, oh, those slaves are just happy they're being taken care of, right? And we're good slave owners. And so you need to bring those... You can't pretend that you know what those people are going to be. And I think that's a real flaw for me in this approach, is that it requires me as an individual to pretend that I can be empathy for everybody. And I can't, because I don't know what it's like to, let's say, hunt a wolf and kill it. I have no idea. So I can't empathize with that person that wants to do that. I need to talk to him or her and understand that in order to make a decision on that.
Although, doesn't that fit into what you were talking about with the reflective equilibrium, that there's a starting point of, here's this thought experiment, and if I don't know what it's like to kill a wolf,
right,
and I'm wanting to, I may be in that particular position now after Out of the Veil, I have work to do in order to understand, or in order to gain a better appreciation, understanding of what that might be or what's at stake.
And I think that's right, but I also think there's a way in which, you know, if we're being fair to Rawls, like, there are situations in which we have to do that because we have to decide kind of what policy outcomes there will have. But thinking really about David's point now about, like, it being a political conception, there's also the way in which I'm not required to necessarily understand everybody, right? I want to give people as much freedom to design their own lives as possible. I get worried when I have a reason to think that their exercise of freedom is trampling on somebody else's, right? So they're claiming a certain kind of religious freedom or freedom to hunt or whatever it is, and that starts binding up other people. That's wrong. And I also have, so I can assume that people want freedom, and I don't think that's a large assumption. I don't have to understand people all that well to understand that they probably want to be able to, like, have their own opinions and raise the kids the way they want, etc. And then I only really cry foul when I start to think, like, that's imposing on my freedoms. You know, my daughter's preschool shut down for a week last week, so I had to be at home for a week because you were out doing something else. Now I'm kind of pissed off, right, because now I'm stuck at home. But, you know, so those kinds of things, then I start to speak up, but otherwise, not a whole lot. And also, I assume people are bothered by inequality unless it benefits them, right? And that also seems like a pretty safe assumption about human beings, that they don't like to have less than other people. Unless there's some system where, as Marisa was saying earlier, where we kind of agree to the terms of the game and say, yeah, okay, you want to do that, you can have more money. I would hate doing that. I'm okay having less. And overall, having both of us in society improves it. So I think the empathy question is a really interesting one. I mean, there's a way in which we can see this requiring a lot of empathy. But viewed in another way, it makes kind of minimal, I think, assumptions about what human beings want. But I'm still thinking through it. Yeah.
Well, it's not just about us. No. But that's the thing, if you do extend it to animals, like, we don't. Like, I can think more of, like, what it would be like to you or a homeless person than I can think to what it would be like to be a wolf. You know, because we don't think the way they do. At least I don't know if we do.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when you do extend it to a wild animal, for example, like, there, that's ultimate freedom. Like, yeah, they may have that ultimate freedom of, like, doing whatever they want, but they're also living in a in an environment where they don't get shelter necessarily, they don't get food necessarily, because they do have to hunt them. We like, and we live in a society where we can go to McDonald's and just buy a burger for $3, and yeah, so it's like, you really can't put yourself in that mindset, at least.
Although Leopold would say, think like a mountain, right? I think that was part of his venture.
Yeah, being
try and, yeah, perspectival shifts of things. But yeah, to truly experience what it would feel like to be a wolf would probably be very challenging. But to think about what a wolf might think about, I think we could venture into.
And I don't think that, maybe this is what you were getting at a minute ago, I don't think Rawls, this goes back to what she said, Marie, I don't think he requires us to extend that, to extend consideration to what it would be like to be you. I don't think he does that. He just has to say, just imagine that no matter what comes out of this thing here that we're doing, that you might be less off than what you are today. And that in itself may just be enough and sufficient to get people to the table to think about it. Even though I have no idea what your life looks like. But it's not required that I do.
Maybe minimally, right? I think there are certain kind of basic goods we have to spell out. And I think part of what we're getting at here in some ways are like, what are those basic goods? And, you know, maybe for human beings, there's some we could think are relatively non-controversial, right? Health and and education and political participation and certain things that seem to benefit people across the board, even if I don't have thick conceptions of what they really want in life or what they care about or if they want to think like a mountain or not. And so I do think, you know, even with wolves, I don't, you know, again, this is not a Rawlsian extension. This is somebody else's extension of Rawls. But I think I don't know exactly what it's like to be a wolf. But in order to even take a wolf seriously in my considerations of justice, I'd have to spell out some conditions of what a good life for a wolf
is. Well, and that's what it takes, is actually considering this wolf's life as a valuable thing.
Sure.
A lot of times it's like, yeah, smoke a pack a day. Mm-hmm. Like those very hard...
Does that hurt wolves?
Statement.
It's a high level.
I'm saying smoke a pack a day in terms of I'm going to kill an entire pack of wolves today because
you haven't seen that.
I'm thinking like wolf monkey. I'm so dumb.
That's the thing. Like, people literally will walk around saying,
I thought you were joking.
So yeah, let's kill all the wolves. And it's like, it's bigger than that. You can't just kill all the wolves.
I think kind of what you guys have been pointing out too is that it's not just about satisfaction or happiness in necessarily system, it's about fairness, right? So we're not talking of, like, I mean, imagining what it would be like to be them or whatever, but these values that we're establishing to have a good life, we need the opportunity and the freedom and the access to these things. And then if you don't go grab those things because you decided to smoke a pack a day or like whatever, then I'm sorry you're unhappy, but like you had the same opportunity, you had the same freedom and the same, like, you know, fairness. But satisfaction isn't guaranteed, I guess, in the system. It's kind of what I'm asking or posing or getting compromised.
Well, the reason why I sort of push back a little bit to that, because I think this is a cop out. It is a cop out to the minimally to the thought experiment. Because I can always say, or you could always say, to use you as an example, well, Thomas, you didn't really understand my life, you know. And or I can say, you know what, we have this idea of justice here, but, you know, I'm just still kind of a little uneasy because I don't know all the details about Marisa's life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a cop-out.
It's
a cop-out to sort of... to jeopardize or hijack, not hijack, but to sort of walk away from the negotiations.
Okay.
Because you don't have all of the details? Of incomplete knowledge. Mm-hmm. I just don't know what your life looks like.
So we won't make any decisions.
So that way, you know, you guys continue to talk about this, you know, I'm going to step out of that veil now because it's just untenable. You know, I cannot go there. So that's why I don't think it's required, or it should be required. Yeah.
And regret.
When you said, well, maybe I can imagine myself in a scenario that I'll be worse off, right? And so I better do better. But that very same argument is used by a lot of people who don't want to tax the rich and say, maybe someday I'll be rich, right? And maybe someday I'll have this false value of money. So I don't want the rules to change because, I mean, it can go either way. You can imagine yourself as, you know, someday I want to be president and make all the decisions. So I don't want power restricted. And so that to me is also a flaw in this way of thinking.
So. Yeah, and I think this is a big question in terms of how we construe the original position and what comes out of it, right? Is how do you think about, and I mentioned this earlier, you know, kind of how do you think about human psychology in that? And Rawls's, I think, commitment, and I don't think he's necessarily wrong, but I think it's interesting to challenge, is that if we're really kind of forming the basic rules of a society and I'm coming in not knowing anything about where I'm going to end up, then I'm going to be more worried about who's at what's the worst possible outcome I could face, that I'm going to be more concerned about that than I am about the best possible outcome. In a situation of pure kind of ignorance, worrying about the, like, what's the worst that could happen, in the way that, you know, we might see people get really kind of overly concerned about safety when they don't know the threat level of something, right? Like, if I don't know the threat level, I'm really just going to make sure I'm prepared for anything, right? And I think Rawls would say the people you're talking about who don't want to change power structures are already pretty convinced that they could possibly benefit from those power structures, right? And that the work of the veil is supposed, or the work of the original position, is supposed to really put you at a position where you don't know.
Take you out of that comfort zone.
Yeah, I kind of like, you know, these power structures because lots of presidents have kind of looked like me, and so let's keep this system the way it is because I'll take my shots. Maybe I'll build up a little bit of constituency here. My rise is coming. But if I really didn't know who I would end up, right, I'd end up in whoever you think is the most disadvantaged member of the society. That all of a sudden that starts bothering you and making you more. But I think it's a really good question as to whether or not has that effect on our psychology or not.
And I know that that's
philosophy, like, it's not just one philosopher that has the answers, it's like multiple different ones that you are all thought experiments that make you think differently and make you think from different perspectives. And I think that's like what you're doing is really cool. Like, we're all sitting here listening to each other's perspectives based off of this man's perspective. And, you know, learning and maybe taking a couple things that, which Glow's probably like, don't take a couple things. But, like, I mean, I don't know. Like, as a professor, I would like, I like this. Like, you just, like, cherry pick what you like from each philosopher and kind of, like, practice it in your life. And, like, that's what speaks to you. Mm-hmm. That's what I like about philosophy. It's like, I just learn different perspectives and, like, maybe thinking about things in a different way.
Yeah, what's kind of neat about that too, just to continue on that, I know we're also at the tail end, we're a little bit over, so I will keep this brief, but just this idea of sort of keeping that conversation alive or engaging with these ideas that were presented in this very particular way by Rawls, and certainly he's been in a conversation with ideas that were presented with people long before, so we're continuing to be part of this larger sort of thinking process, and I think that's really cool.
And there are loopholes. That's what's fun, you can, like, find them.
I want to thank everyone for coming out here today. I hope that you have some things to continue thinking about. This can certainly, there's a lot of other situations we can look at as to whether or not Rawls's conception might hold weight else, or, you know, fall short in different places. We have a couple things on the radar for the rest of this month. Next week, that's right, already. No, 2 weeks from now, October 13th. We have a Thinking About Place community workshop. There's some preparatory work for that, so you can check that on our workshop if you're interested. We also have our monthly Think and Drinks the night after that. That's in the pavilion on October 14th. And then we'll be offering another philosophy walk near the end of this month on the 23rd. David Nowakowski is actually going to be leading that one, and that is on quirky virtues, which should be very fun. So you can find out more information about that on our website as well. So thank you so much for spending your morning and afternoon. Ed, thank you for spending your morning with us. Really fun. Mm-hmm.